Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I am playing the first half of an extraordinary interview with an extraordinary man. Wayne Adams is everything. Actor, director, producer, art gallery owner, waiter, lighting designer. If it has something to do with creativity, if it has something to do with work, if it has something to do with investment in life, Wayne Adams has done it, been it, explored it, thought about it, and in this interview talks about it. This is really one of a kind, and because I didn't want to end it even when I did, it's very long, and so this is only part one. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh, I really can. Oh, I really can. Turn down all
to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being all that you can be, about recognizing if maybe, perhaps, there was something about you, something that you were interested in, something that was natural to you, something organic, something that you might have done or been, but because of something that happened in your childhood, in your family, in your school, in your church, in your culture, on the playground, you decided to hide that, to pretend you were not that. And because we human beings are so clever and so flexible, if you decided with enough passion and energy that this, whatever it was, maybe it was the color of your hair, maybe it was the way you laughed, maybe it was your interest in clothing, maybe it was your desire to, say, make jokes, maybe it was that you were quiet and shy, maybe it was that you liked to read, or maybe it was that you didn't like to read but you liked to play sports. Well, whatever it was, it didn't go down well with somebody significant. And if that happened to you, And as a result, you did what so many of us do, which is not only hide it and pretend not to have it, but then forget that you had it. This is an ironic thing about the human brain. We can actually forget who we are. So that if, for some reason, that happened to you in some little aspect of your life or some really major aspect of your life, then you are being cheated today from all that you can be, all that you actually are, from the joy of being you. So the Lynn Show is all about trying to make this point that this does actually happen to more of us than you might believe. It may have happened to you. And if it did, it is my hope that by listening to the show, you might be tempted to wonder, ask yourself, be curious, remember a moment, an incident, something might come back. And if that happens, then you might ask yourself, do I want to recover all that I am? Do I want to be all that I am? And if the answer is yes, then let me alert you to the fact that simply saying yes is not enough. It can be work because you didn't deny this part of yourself frivolously. You believed that there was a price to pay for it. That's why you did it. And when you try and recover it, quite often the fear of the price comes back with it. Of course, this is what psychotherapy is all about. This is one of the things that psychotherapy is all about, and of course I speak as a psychotherapist. So you might want to think about going into therapy to talk about this idea that there is a part of you that you suspect is there, or even know is there, and want to recover safely, with someone helping you to deal with whatever it was you thought the consequences of that recovery would be. If you want to talk to me about that, you can go up on my website, thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com, and there's a place to click on to contact me, and it's an email connection, but I answer all the questions. Also, I do psychotherapy on the telephone now exclusively, so if that is intriguing to you, there's an article up on the website that talks about what therapy on the phone is like. It's called Psychotherapy on the Go. And I wrote a book, and it's up there as well. And the other thing that's up on the website is our podcasts of all of my shows and all of the interviews that I've ever done, including the one I'm going to play right now with Wayne Adams. And Wayne is the poster child for you can be everything you are. When you listen to Wayne, you can hear what it sounds like to be open to yourself and whatever the world presents to you, you can embrace if it is an interest of yours, if it is part of your instinct. And Wayne will talk a little bit about that at the end of this interview, and then we'll pick that up again in the next one, because this is just part one. And truth to tell, I could have talked to Wayne for yet another several hours and probably never had covered all of what he has done, what he is. But what's really significant in this interview, you will hear as I did, is the passion, the joy, the investment in his life. So I don't want to say another word because Wayne says it better than me. So here now, Wayne Adams. Okay, I'm here with Wayne Adams in my hotel room at the Hilton. And I've explained to Wayne that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I want to say that the art to which you have given so much of your life and made your living with is the theater. I know that there are other arts to which you have given your life. How would you describe it?
Well, basically, I do whatever is next.
Yes.
If it's something that I want to do.
Right.
And in terms of the arts, mm-hmm. my life has embraced dance, mm-hmm. acting, mm-hmm. producing, directing, mm-hmm. and acting in film as well as stage. I had an art gallery.
Oh my.
At one point. In fact, I was one of the persons responsible for outfitting this hotel when it initially opened with real art.
Oh my God.
You know, instead of, you know, the kind of things that yes. we see in hotels
yes.
today.
So truly, you are an artist, period.
I like to think of myself
as
an artist at life.
Yes, yes.
That's the way I feel about
okay,
it all.
So I usually ask just this one question. And it will be interesting to hear how it applies to you. The question I usually ask is, do you remember the first moment in your life when it occurred to you that art would be important, that you wanted to create things, that you liked having attention paid, because of course actors have a lot of attention paid to any of this? Does this mean anything to you, this question?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think probably when I first started studying piano at 7, I think mm-hmm. 6 or 7.
And do you remember, was that did you say, I really like music, or I really like the piano, or your mother said, you have to play piano?
I don't remember.
You just remember that you began.
I remember that, but I think it began because my parents, I am an mm-hmm. only child, an adopted only child.
Wow.
And they wanted me to experience as much as possible. So really, at a young age, I was taken to concerts in Cleveland, Ohio, or in Columbus, or in Cincinnati, and we would drive, you know, for an opera or a concert or an orchestra.
So a couple of things occur to me here. One of them is, a lot of people adopt. It sounds like the people who adopted you wanted a child, and they wanted to give this child a really full life. No? No?
Not no.
Yes. No!
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, they wanted to expose me to
yes.
it. They were, the only time they sort of came down upon me mm. was practicing the piano.
Yes, right.
But before the piano, I would say, well, I was adopted because my mother, not my birth mother, whom I did meet, but my adopted mother, who is my mother,
yes.
Said, we're going to take you to things because we want you to know what is out in the world.
Yes.
And when I was old enough to be informed that I had been adopted, she told me that the best they could do was put me out there into my life with a couple of provisos. One being, you must do what you want to do, but you must be entirely responsible for whatever you do. Only you can be responsible for it. So you can't come to us and say, oh, I don't like this, I'm not, you know, it's up to you.
Right, or I need help with this, or I couldn't
well,
do it well enough.
Well, they would be ready to help.
Yes.
But Bertha, her name, mm-hmm. was, Bertha bore a baby boy, and he died 2 weeks later.
Oh my.
And she and Edgar sat down and said, we're going to get a boy. We're not going to grieve about this. It's finished. It's the way it is.
Yeah.
We're going to find a boy.
Wow.
And they found me.
Yes.
And it seems to me that that this was an extremely serendipitous joining. They found a boy who could be what they wanted, who could embrace what they offered, who could take and run with what they offered. No?
Yeah, that's right. I didn't necessarily embrace everything immediately. I was a little slow on many
levels. Never mind, but over time, you got around to everything.
Well, that very thing that I related, that Mother said to me, mm-hmm. Has been the guiding factor of my life.
Yes. So, okay, so you take piano lessons at 7, and then what happens?
Well, it was, I didn't enjoy practicing.
Mm. Me either.
And I kind of ground it out for a while, and I stayed with it, I think it was into high school, and then I stopped it. Mm-hmm. However, it gave me a basic understanding of music, which I have used thousands of times over the years. So I'm really happy that, that Bertha, she called me Sonny Boy. She'd say, Sonny Boy, get up, you practice first, then you eat.
Wow. Wow. Well, that's motivation.
Yeah, that's motivation for sure.
Right. Okay, so music became important to you, but not playing.
No.
Okay, so then what did you discover next? I mean, you've got all of these.
Well, I always drew and painted, and in high school I played the trombone, and I was the director of the little band that followed the basketball team wherever we went, wherever we played.
Wow.
You know, which was a great gig.
That's right.
You
know, yes, right. Right.
And Bertha would always drive us. Anywhere I had to go, she would drive.
Uh-huh. Right.
I remember one snow-ridden night, we were on the way back from a game. I don't remember where it was, but it was snowing so heavily. And she'd say, Wayne Edgar, open the car window and look out and let me know when I leave the road.
Oh, dear.
I remember that so clearly, which was kind of frightening.
Yes,
but she would go, it didn't matter what was going on.
No, she was something.
Yeah, well, she was really something.
Yes. Okay, so now we have the piano and the trombone and we have painting and drawing. Did you know what you wanted to do?
Well,
I
acted in high school.
You did, right.
And,
Did you have a plan, or?
Kind of. I wanted to go to Washington University in St. Louis in architecture.
Oh.
I don't know whether that started when I was really young, because I had a passion for fire. And whenever there was any kind of knowledge that there was a big fire somewhere, I insisted that we get in the car and go and see as much of the building burn as possible.
Oh, my God.
Yes, I loved fires. I really did. And so I had all kinds of passions, but I loved architecture, too.
And
there was a fascination to me. Since a fire is overtaking a structure, to see what happens when it collapses, or if it does collapse. It was a combination of all those things.
Yes.
But,
So did you go to school?
Oh, yeah.
For architecture?
I could not, because I was out of state, I couldn't get in. Mm-hmm. I would have to have waited a year in order to get in, and I went to Ohio University. In Athens, Ohio, fell in love with the Southern Ohio Hills and with Ohio University, and never thought twice about going to Washington University.
And what did you major in?
I majored in commercial design, and I minored in history of architecture.
Yes. My God, what did you think you were going to do? Oh, did you?
I I started in my freshman year in the theater. At that time, it was open. There was not a theater department as such. And it was an open call on all shows.
Right.
You know, you could go and try out, and if they felt you were good, you might get in.
They get a role, right.
So I spent my 4 years. I did 11 major productions. I never took a theater course.
Wow. You just did it.
Well, I did it, and I became known to the directors, you know, as someone they could depend on, and kind of, I was good, and I knew what I could do well, mm-hmm. and I didn't think of it at that time in terms of communication. I really liked being out there, and I was 50 at the time that I really got it. I really understood what acting is.
Okay, wait a second. Hold on. So you're saying, this is what I hear, but maybe it's not right, that in school you did a lot of acting.
Yeah.
But it was spontaneous for you and more like play. Is that not true?
At that point.
Yes, at that point.
I think right. Yes. Mm-hmm. But by the time I graduated from college and went into the Air Force, because I was Air Force ROTC, so I went in as a lieutenant, second lieutenant, mm-hmm. and I was pretty determined to do the 2 years, which were required,
right.
and then hightail directly to New York, which actually is what I ended up doing.
Thinking that you would pursue acting? Or you weren't sure what, right?
Yes. Right. I had no idea what that pursuit
meant.
Would mean.
right.
You know.
I do, but it was the thing that most captured you at the moment, so you were doing it.
It captured me really deeply. And I often say to myself, would it have had captured me and taken me deeply enough into it that I understood what it was really all about early on, but it takes... Whatever it takes.
So, do you think that if you had studied, you would have gotten it sooner, or you think it was
no
something
idea.
About...
Okay. I have no idea.
Okay. I'm curious. I mean, I want to hear what happened in the intervening 30 years. But when you say you got it, can you talk about what that meant?
It was a production of David Mamet's A Life in the Theater, a two-character play. Mm-hmm. I'd never done a two-character play. I had done some leading roles, and I had done much theater. This was when I was 50 years old. Mm-hmm. And a young director that was living next door to me, where I live right now, had... directed a couple of plays for me in a theater that I created called Wonder Horse, which is now New York, no, not New York Live Arts, that was Dance Theater Workshop. It's now New York Theater Workshop, mm-hmm. down in East 4th Street. Mm-hmm. And the building next to the main theater, I took a space, I leased the building, and I created a 99-seat house there, and I produced some things there. And this young man had worked with me on a cabaret, and he lit 2 or 3 of the productions that I produced there. And then he left New York City, and I really didn't know where he was, and he ended up being one of the founding members of, oh, here we go, trying to think of things down near Washington, D.C., of a theater which became one of the first regional theaters to actually be operating in the black, and
wow.
did for many, many years. Maybe I'll remember the name of it, but it was like outside of D.C. and Philadelphia. It was in that general area, mm-hmm. but in the countryside.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And years later, I got a call from him, and he said, Wayne, And I said, oh my gosh, where have you been? He said, well, I'm right outside of Philadelphia. I have my own theater. And I want to talk to you about something. He said, I'm about to direct a play. And in the process of preparing myself for it, and it's going to be in my own theater, I keep hearing your voice. And I said, well, my goodness.
How nice.
Yeah, that's very nice. Uh-huh. I've always thought my voice was just a little peculiar, actually. But if you keep hearing it, to what extent? And he said, well, I would like you to play Robert in David Mamet's A Life in the Theater. And I said, oh my God. I saw that when I had a play at the Cherry Lane, True West, which I produced, introducing John Malkovich and Gary Sinise.
Oh my God.
To the greater arena. We had a 2-year sold-out run at that gorgeous theater, mm-hmm. actually off Broadway's earliest, really earliest theater mm-hmm. as such. And Mamet's play was playing at the Lucille Lortel, which is now the Lucille Lortel. It was the Theatre de Lys then.
Oh, yes.
And so I nipped over one night and saw it. And it was an amazing experience. And I came out of it thinking, my goodness, how wonderful. Who was the man who played Robert in the initial production? Wonderful American actor who became very, very ill when he was in his late 40s and went blind.
Oh, dear.
And, I'm not sure that I will come up with it, but he was the original Robert mm-hmm. in this play at the Theatre de Lys. Mm-hmm. And the young man who played the young man
right.
the young actor, was not good.
Oh.
And I couldn't understand how this brilliant actor would want to do this two-character play with
somebody who wasn't
who wasn't really up to it.
Wow.
I mean, he was not bad, but he wasn't there
yes.
with it the way. And then I found out by doing a little research that this young man was his lover.
Oh.
And then I wondered, why would a beautiful actor like that do that? Why
do that
would he insist
on
that his lover, young lover, play the young boy if he didn't feel, maybe he felt he was up to it. I don't know, but he wasn't.
You know,
I kept saying, this play is fabulous. I wish I had seen it with two wonderful actors. So then we jump
yes,
to
right.
this conversation.
Right.
And he said, do you think you would be interested in doing it? And I said, yes. And I was working with International Herald Tribune at the time. I was managing, taking care of all relations with international guests of the newspaper at the New York office, which I loved doing. And there was a new woman coming into a prime job under which I would continue to operate in the job I was in. And she was trying to get herself into things, and I approached her. I said, I'm going to be leaving to do a play, and I'll be gone for a certain amount of time. She said, you can't. I can't. You are the one person that is feeding me everything I need to know. And I said, well, I joined International Herald Tribune on the basis that if something came up for me as an actor or a theatrical that I wanted to produce, that I could take a leave of absence. And she went to the president and said, I don't want him
to go.
Yeah. And I went into him and I said, look, this is the basis on which I accepted. He said, Wayne, could you break it up you know, could in the rehearsal period, could you spend the first 3 hours of the day here at the office and then take the train down to Philadelphia or drive? I had a car then.
Right.
Or drive. And I said, do you really think it's necessary for me to be here? And he said, she's very nervous about this, and we like her, and we want her, you know. So I agreed to do that.
Oh, my.
Which was a really bad decision. Yes. So the whole rehearsal process was set
yes.
according to this.
And you were, and your preparing for this was interrupted over and over
yeah,
again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I got to a point where we were going into final rehearsal week and approaching tech rehearsals. And the director, Ken Marini, said, I'd like to talk to the two of you, the other principal actor with me. And he said, we were finished with rehearsal and we sat on the apron of this sweet little stage. It was his theater. And he said, Wayne, this is actually about you. I wanted you for this role, and I still want you for this role, but I'm not getting you.
Yes, right. But I want you for
yeah.
this role, right.
And I said, I know it's very hard. And I said, I want to tell you something happened a couple of nights ago. I drove back home. And I got the car parked and went in and climbed into my loft and went to sleep. And I woke an hour later and I couldn't remember having driven from Philadelphia to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I got so frightened.
Yes.
And he said, well, that's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You do not know your lines. You do not know from scene to scene what
oy,
the sequence
oy, oy.
Is. We're going in, you know, and so I called a dear friend in New York. Her name is Penelope Kokel, who was then writing for television. A young lady whom I held in my hands when she was born.
Oh.
And, I call her Peeps, Penelope, Peepsy. And I told her what had happened and what I'm feeling. And she said, do you know your lines? And I said, you know, I think I do, yes, but I'm having trouble with the sequences. And she said, do you want to continue? And I said, yes, I really, really want to do this. And I said, I was met with the director tonight saying that if I didn't come to the rehearsal tomorrow morning with my lines and my knowledge of the scenes and the relationship of one scene to another, that he would not open the show. So she said, well, Wayne, this is rough. I said, yeah. And she said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to stay up all night and find out what it is I know or don't know. So I did. And I didn't focus on the lines, but I focused on charting the scenes and constantly you know, going from, segueing from one scene into another and knowing that it was next. Because we had a production where the director had us both in our own dressing rooms on the stage. And we would dress in front of the audience and then walk into the next scene. It was an amazing production of the play. And by the time it was 9 in the morning, I slept for 1 hour and then I drove basically, you know, to the 11 o'clock rehearsal, shaking and, you know, really being very, very exhausted. And we did a run-through, and I wasn't quite there in terms of scene sequence and so forth, but I found out that I knew my lines.
Yes.
And it was that was screwing everything up.
That you didn't, that you hadn't known them?
That I knew them. But because I did not know where I was at a given time, and I was worrying about, oh my God, what is the next scene? I can't remember. What do I have to wear? You know,
I
was torturing myself, where actually I did know the lines.
Yes.
So we then did two tech runs, and we then did a dress rehearsal without costumes, and another dress with the costumes. And everybody was so thrilled that the show was not going to close.
People
were open.
Right.
And I was so excited. And we had the opening night. And it really, really went flawlessly. But I was working with an actor who was so giving and so knowledgeable and understanding. And my director, Ken, was so beautiful with everything that the performance, you know, was really, really a glorious experience. Mm-hmm. But through all of this process and the difficulties I had had, mm-hmm. I was forced to be in a position of understanding something about acting that I had never embraced before. And that was that, and I had 25 stories to tell, mm-hmm. that all I needed to do was tell the story. And I said this to myself, and I had never really studied acting. I studied with a couple of teachers, mm-hmm. over my early years in New York, but that opening night where I just released myself into telling the stories with and all for the first time, you know, with the audience, that decision I made at the beginning, just before the opening night.
It's not acting, in quotes.
Yeah.
Right.
So, it was over. And I went back to my dressing room, and a very favorite face poked into my door, and it was Austin Pendleton.
Oh.
And he said, Wayne. I said, oh my God, you came down here for the opening. Austin, he said, well, I just said, since I've directed you in several plays, since you've used me as a director,
right.
twice on Broadway and off-Broadway, I figured I wanted to be there. Mm-hmm. And I said, did you take the train down? He said, yes. And I said, well, I'm driving back. So why don't you drive back with me? He said, okay. So I got myself ready. We got into the car. And we were driving to where we joined the New Jersey Turnpike.
Yes, right.
You know, you had to get off of the Pennsylvania Turnpike and go into the New Jersey Turnpike. And he hadn't said anything.
Oh my God!
And he was quiet. And
Austin,
you guys. And I thought, oh. And I said, Austin. And he said, oh, yeah, yes. And I said, are you going to talk about what happened to you tonight? And he said, oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I said, do you know when? So we were now on the last lap,
right,
because
right.
I drive very fast.
Right.
And he said, well, I'm thinking about it, and I really want to be in a position to really say what I'm feeling.
Yes.
And I said, oh, well, that's terrific.
Yes.
And then I drove a little further, and we were at the first place where you could go off to the side and take a rest, one of those rest stops,
right.
The very first one above Philadelphia. And I said, how's it going in your mind? It's a rest stop. And he said, let's pull up. So I pulled up, pulled up, middle of the night, turned off the engine, and he said, well, first of all, the two of you were perfectly matched. And it's one of the finest performances I have ever seen on the stage where two actors were really working with each other.
Oh my God.
But the other side of it is you both just told the stories. You communicated.
Right. You were real.
And I believed everything that you did. And that coming from Austin. You know? So, from that point on, my view of acting totally changed. And I didn't do a great deal of acting. After that, we had two producers wanting to bring the show to Off-Broadway. And Mamet had withdrawn the play from the possibility of being done anywhere near New York City because they were about to present the made-for-television film of it, which was a disaster. And so here were two producers ready with the bucks and everything.
Right.
And by the time all that was done and all that was out of the way and his agent decided, you know, everything had dissipated. You know how
right.
it is.
No, it's you strike when the iron is right, or you don't. Yeah.
I don't know what question I just answered.
Well, let me direct then.
Okay.
Okay, so I asked this. You answered the question I asked. So now I would like to move back to you come out of college and you go into the Air Force, and then the Air Force is over and then you do come to New York. Is that
yes.
correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so you came to New York thinking that you would act.
Yes.
And is that what happened?
Pretty much closely. After I arrived.
Mm-hmm.
I also love design. And do you remember Bronzini of New York? And 5 East 52nd Street, just off Fifth Avenue?
No, I don't.
Bronzini was the finest necktie store. That's all it was, neckties, in New York. That time. I mean, Countess Mara, you know,
yes,
was
right.
on and all that kind of thing. But these were hand silk screen printed mm-hmm. fine silk ties for a roaring cost of $650, $750, or a couple of hundred, depending upon the nature of the silk that had been, you know, custom made
right.
for it. And I was so taken in the New Yorker magazine. When I was in college, I was reading the New Yorker magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the only American magazine I have ever subscribed to. And it's still with me.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do a 2-page spread with one necktie. And I really dug that. I really got that, you know, completely. So I wrote to the owner, creator of Bronzini,
mm-hmm.
and said I was in the Air Force and that I have been wearing only Bronzini ties for 2 or 3 years now, and I'm coming to New York City after the Air Force. And I love everything surrounding what you make, the way you make it, and the way you put it out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really like, if it were possible, to have an appointment to meet with you and see if there might be a spot, you know, in that, all of that for me. Mm-hmm. And I got a letter back very, very quickly saying, please give us, you know, a few weeks advance notice. Yes, I would like to meet with you. So I met with Alban Holder, who had just recently purchased Bronzini from the young man who is a Broadway gypsy.
You're kidding.
Who created it.
Wow.
He was from Canada. And I never met him. But he loved making his clothes. He made all of his own clothes. And he was a gypsy, a very successful dancer on Broadway. Mm-hmm. And he was making clothes for everybody in the shows that he knew. And he got this idea of really making very, very special ties. Mm-hmm. And that's what evolved. And it had just been purchased. And Alvin Holder hired me.
To do what?
I became a server. I had learned the process. It was no ordinary process. The ties were created in collections. Each collection would have six colorations of the same design. And most of the designs were inspired by the interior of classic book covers.
Oh my.
Not the book jacket, but the actual book cover. Mm-hmm. And sort of classically oriented, but reduced to a simplicity of almost bordering on modernism. Mm-hmm. Very smart. Mm-hmm. Really very, very wonderful. And there were beautiful marble tables, only two of them, and these beautiful cushioned stools, and people who came in to select a tie were invited to be seated. And then you would talk with them about, is there some kind of color that you're interested in, or do you know what kind? Tell me what you may be interested in.
This is high-class customer service.
Yeah.
Right?
And then they would give you an indication, and then I would go to the drawers on the wall, and depending upon what the customer said, I would pull a drawer out and bring it over to the marble table. I was standing behind the table. The customer was seated right there. And there were thick velvet flaps that covered it. You would open one flap and then the other, revealing the six different colorations of that particular design.
Oh, my God.
And that's...
It's a performance.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It was right up.
Yes, right up your alley. Right?
And loving good design. Now, I'll just skip to the end of this. Mm-hmm. By the time I was there, about a year and a half, loving it, I was allowed to take summer to do summer stock, mm-hmm. which was great.
Yes.
And I returned from my second summer of summer stock to realize that the young man who did the window, a window, about this big to the top of that mirror. That was the window.
Right.
And usually only one tie in the window. And extravagant things would be done.
Yes.
He had died.
Oh, dear.
And Mr. Holder called me in. And he was a sweetheart of a guy. And we got to know each other. He had been ill, apparently. I didn't know it. And he said, you know, he came to me before he actually left, while you were gone this summer. And he said, I think you should talk to Wayne about doing the windows.
Jesus.
So I ended up doing the windows for the remainder of the time that I was there. And I designed 22 collections at the same time. And continued to serve customers because I loved it. And I met people like Mrs. Eugene O'Neill. And one Christmas, she came in, Carlotta O'Neill, in the Russian fur hat and the Russian coat, dragging on the floor. And Wally Foote, one of the super salesmen there, was
her guy.
Yeah. Wally was off that day, and she came in, and I came out, and I said, "Oh, hello, Mrs. O'Neill," and she said, "Hello, Wayne, may I have dear Wally?" And I said, "Well, he's not here today." And she said, "Oh, well, might I have you?" I said, "Well, yes." So this was right at Christmas time, and she bought about $3,000 worth of ties or other ancillary things too, you know. But at the end, she said, "Now you've got to help me with this. I want a tie for a very special person that I know, and." I wouldn't say that he's very elegant, but he's very sharp, and he really has a great sense of fine things, and I want to select something very special, not necessarily, you know, the printed designs, but I know you have at Christmas time very fine silks. I said we have, and I said I've got something in mind right now. It's just amazing, and I think you're going to love it. It's a French silk that is woven for us, and it's actually a leaf design, but you're not sure whether it's leaves or whether it is a beautiful design. And it's very dark. It's a combination of black and dark green. And I said, "It's so rich." And so I said, "Let me get it." So I went back and I brought it out, and I laid out a velvet cloth and put it on the cloth, and she said, "Oh, Wayne, this is perfect. Now, I want you to have this beautifully wrapped." And the lady who did our wrapping was an extraordinary woman.
Of course.
I went back and I said, "Carlotta O'Neill wants a really sharp, you know, wrap on this." She said, "Okay." And she did a great, great job. I brought it out, together with all the other things all packaged up for her. And she had already stood and was beginning to pull herself together. And she said, "Wayne, thank you. Give my love to Wally." I said, "I will. He'll be very, very sad that he missed you." Yeah. And she said, "I'll be in soon. And hopefully we can have a nice chat when I come in." I said, "I would love that." And she gathered herself together and started out there. She said, oh my goodness, I almost forgot." And she opened this bag and pulled out this beautifully wrapped tie and said, "Merry Christmas, Wayne."
Oh my God. I have tears in my eyes. My God. That's extraordinary. But it is the sort of thing, it seems to me, that happened to you over and over again in your life.
And what I'm saying there about it happening over and over again in Wayne's life, that is really the truth. It's a testament to the way in which he does everything that he does, and he does everything. And you will hear more about that in the second part of this interview. And in the second part of the interview, we're going to talk, well, not we, but Wayne is going to talk more about his involvement in the theater, his producing, his directing, his acting, the way in which he got involved with Steppenwolf, which for those of you who know anything about the theater, know that it's a premier acting company out of Chicago that has produced many of the stars that you see on the theater and TV and film. And Wayne is responsible for bringing several of those. I'm not going to give it away to the Broadway stage. And he will talk about that in the next next show, actually, part two of my interview with the unbelievable Wayne Adams. So, just to wrap up, remember, in case you want to talk to me, check out any of the past shows, and want to know anything about me, you can find all of that on my website, thelynnshow.com. And as always, I hope that you heard something that you can use in this show, something that interested you or intrigued you, something that made you think about yourself in a different way, something that opened an area or an avenue of exploration for you, something that made you laugh the way Wayne and I laughed, something that you just enjoyed, something that will bring you back. Because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight, no. I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated. Oh, fight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, dang, no, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no. Go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten